Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Sierra Oncology, we pass the mic to Ruben A. Mesa, MD, Director of the Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio MD Anderson Cancer Center, and Aaron Gerds, MD, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Hematology and Medical Oncology Department at the Cleveland Clinic Taussig Cancer Institute, to discuss the current landscape of myelofibrosis and key takeaways from the 2020 ASH Annual Meeting and Exposition for the field. In our exclusive interview, Mesa and Gerds provided insight into the current utility of JAK inhibitors in myelofibrosis, unmet needs, and novel agents and combination strategies in the pipeline.
Hello, my name is Ruben Mesa, and I'm the Executive Director of the Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio MD Anderson. And I'm joined today by my good friend and colleague, Dr. Aaron Gerds from the Cleveland Clinic. Aaron, why don't you say a word or two about yourself?
Hey, Ruben, thank you so much. Always a pleasure to be speaking with you, that's for sure. I am at the Cleveland Clinic. I'm an associate professor of medicine here. Also the medical director of the Case Comprehensive Cancer Center Clinical Research Office, as well as the deputy director for clinical research at the Taussig Cancer Center.
Well, Aaron and I have the distinction both being good friends for many years, but I was the inaugural panel chair for the NCCN guidelines for myeloproliferative neoplasms. And Aaron succeeded me in that role and is the current panel chair. And because of that, we give a lot of thought to how we approach patients, how do we try to communicate that in ways to both patients as well as to physicians to try to bring about, I think, greater consistency in care around the U.S., as well as greater understandings of what are the goals of therapy? How do we start people on therapy? How do we judge its impact? So in this podcast, we're going to focus on updates from ASH 2020 with a specific eye on myelofibrosis, as well as how some of these things might end up impacting our treatment guidelines in the near future. But first, whenever we're talking about therapies, we really have to first start talking about what are our goals of therapy? Myelofibrosis is a disease that clearly impacts patients in terms of the potential for decreased survival, but also burdens in terms of splenomegaly, cytopenias, and sometimes some very difficult symptoms. So before we talk about new therapies or therapies currently in the pipeline, Aaron, what do you think are some of the main unmet needs we have in myelofibrosis?
Oh, Ruben, yeah, thanks. That's a great question. And we could probably spend about 3 hours talking about that. The first thing that jumps to my mind are cytopenias or low blood counts. There's really kind of two that are predominant in myelofibrosis. One is anemia, low red cell count, and thrombocytopenia, low platelet counts. And anemia is really important because it's common. Roughly 40% of patients at the time of diagnosis will be anemic. And a lot of the therapies that we use to treat a patient's splenomegaly or symptoms can make a patient more anemic. And furthermore, many patients become transfusion dependent over time during the course of their disease. So anemia is really an issue that we're attacking from a number of different angles with new therapies and existing ones as well. The other challenge is thrombocytopenia. Of course, there's the obvious risk of bleeding associated with thrombocytopenia. But again, a lot of the therapies that we use to treat myelofibrosis can worsen thrombocytopenia. So it's with these low blood counts, we're kind of trapped between a rock and a hard place sometimes when we're deciding how to go about an individual's treatment plan.
Many unmet needs we have. At the current time, we have the approval of ruxolitinib as frontline for patients with myelofibrosis. After our accurate diagnosis, assessment of prognosis, disease burden, we make that decision between observation, stem cell transplant, or frontline medical therapy. That being said, probably 80% or so of individuals end up going on to frontline medical therapy. And we have fedratinib now approved broadly, which we considered in frontline and most certainly in second line for individuals that had failed ruxolitinib. But from my end, there were several key takeaways from ASH. And the first one that I think is quite interesting is the discussion of survival. As we've evolved over time, we have seen that there was retrospectively improvement in survival with ruxolitinib from the COMFORT studies. And in a nice analysis done at this year's ASH by the MD Anderson group, they helped to validate that with, let's say, real-world evidence, where they had seen that patients from 2010 on had a longer survival with their myelofibrosis than pre-2010, with their very significant MD Anderson database of patients. And as they stratified by exposure, it seemed fairly clear that it was associated with exposure with ruxolitinib with JAK inhibition. Now, at this year's ASH, we had some additional discussion of possible agents involved with that may have an impact on survival that require further validation in randomized studies. But Aaron, why don't you share a little bit what your takeaways were from the evolving imetelstat story?
Yeah, thank you, Ruben, again. And I agree about the ruxolitinib abstract. It was a really nice look how far we've come moment, right? So before the approval of ruxolitinib and after, and look how the survival has improved for patients. And that study's been done in CML, and it's nice to replicate that in myelofibrosis. But clearly, there's a long way to go in terms of improving survival with patients with myelofibrosis. And one of the drugs that's looking to do that is this imetelstat drug, so a telomerase inhibitor. So telomerase is the enzyme that makes cells immortal. So if you grow cells in a petri dish and you want to keep them immortal forever, and growing, you need to make sure that there's plenty of telomerase around to keep their chromosomes cooking. So this is a telomerase inhibitor, and the idea is that it can really get after the myelofibrosis stem cells, if you will, and root out the disease for true disease modification. And so the analysis that was presented was a kind of a reworking of a phase 2 study in patients with myelofibrosis who had relapsed refractory disease after JAK inhibitors. And they showed a couple important things. One is that the survival was better for higher doses. So there was a dose response effect with higher doses. And, you know, the other major goal of the study was to dig in and see, are there any factors that predict survival in patients receiving imetelstat? Then that way we can inform a randomized phase 3 trial for its design to ultimately what population of patients this drug can benefit the most. And the interesting thing that they found was that improvement in bone marrow fibrosis was associated with a better survival. So patients who had improvement in the grades of fibrosis, the amount of scar tissue seen in their bone marrow, had better survival. They looked at a number of other factors, really didn't see any signals there. So this drug may benefit a broader range of people. But the idea that the fibrosis improvement associated with better survival does suggest disease modification there, which is what we're all searching for, is to improve the survival and root out this disease for patients.
So indeed, you know, novel mechanism of action, active drug, suggestion of improvement in survival. Additionally, I was involved with an abstract regarding momelotinib, looking at both the long-term data of SIMPLIFY-1, the upfront randomized study, and SIMPLIFY-2, both of which have strong suggestions that for those patient populations, their survivals were quite robust compared to where they would have been expected normally. This, for me, broadens the consideration that therapies that deeply have an impact on myelofibrosis, you know, generally impact splenomegaly, generally impact symptoms, undoubtedly impact the rate of progression in the bone marrow or other factors, decreased debilitation, what have you, you know, are likely having an impact on survival. And that over time, I think survival, perhaps progression-free survival, but overall survival will be things that we will look at much more carefully and hopefully develop much better surrogates for phase 3 clinical trials. I do think overall survival is a challenging endpoint for myelofibrosis in the conduct of studies frequently because the length of life individuals have, fortunately, is long enough that to expect people to remain on a control arm indefinitely is not realistic, you know, even potentially unethical, but much more to come. So another key thing I think from this year's ASH, Aaron, is we've got a robust pipeline. We've got two other JAK inhibitors well along in their development in advanced phase 3 programs, momelotinib in the MOMENTUM study, trying to get approved in second line individuals, anemic, heavy symptoms, inhibition of ACVR1, inhibition of hepcidin, improving anemia, pacritinib, active in the myelodepleted phenotype, safe in individuals with marked thrombocytopenia, both can play key roles. But we've got several other drugs, navitoclax, CPI-0610, the LSD1 inhibitor, amongst others. But why don't you give folks just a couple words on each, and then we could talk about the different strategies that are being looked at, either combination in frontline, addition in second line. But those three clearly are generating a lot of buzz.
Yeah, certainly they are. I have patients often coming to me asking about these trials and these trial, you know, the previous trials that have been done in these agents and potential for getting on future studies with these medications. So certainly, but even from a patient perspective, there's a lot of clamoring for new agents. And, you know, the exciting thing is that they appear to be improving our ability to take care of patients. So, you know, I have a slide in my slide deck that I often use, and it basically is myelofibrosis is not CML. Like, it's not a one-hit wonder, and there's multiple pathways we need to target in order to continue to move the needle forward for these patients, whether we're targeting the microenvironment and fibrosis, proliferative signaling, epigenetic regulators, immunotherapies, or even this hematopoietic stem cell maintenance survival and differentiation niche. So certainly adding in additional agents and attacking the pathways outside of their kind of classic JAK-STAT pathway is really important. And so these agents are being developed. You know, and again, there's a trial that was presented at ASH, the addition of navitoclax to ruxolitinib, which really showed some impressive results. The amount of patients who had improvement in their spleen size and symptom burden was significant across the board. So patients who had a TSS reduction of at least 50% at week 24 was about 30% of patients. And roughly 27% of patients had a spleen volume response of at least 35%. So these are heavily pretreated patients, patients with high-risk molecular types that had responses. And to that end, then kind of the neat thing they did in the abstract is they separated out the molecular risk types, thinking that, well, maybe we can identify, again, a subpopulation where this may or may not work better. And actually, a high-risk molecular type did not predict for response in their particular analysis. So again, hopefully a therapy that can be widely applicable. You know, the BET inhibitors, CPI-0610, is one that's really high on everyone's list. I know there's a couple of other BET inhibitors being developed. The idea that BET is a key part of this NF-kappa-B pathway, which we know is key in developing elevated cytokine levels and producing fibrosis and inflammation in the marrow. And the thought is that we can reduce these things by targeting that particular pathway. In the past, BET inhibitors have been pretty toxic, but these kind of newer ones coming along, like CPI-0610, seem to have a better side effect profile. So we can effectively deliver BET inhibition to the patients with myelofibrosis. So the MANIFEST study is the ongoing, the phase two study where there's two major arms. One is the upfront setting, and one is the kind of add-on strategy where they add the BET inhibitor on top of ruxolitinib to improve the outcomes. And you know, in general, the response rates that we see in terms of spleen volume response and symptom response are more than what we would expect to see with just a JAK inhibitor alone. So we think about a JAK inhibitor alone hitting somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 40% spleen volume response at week 24. We're seeing spleen volume responses as high as 67% with the combination of a BET inhibitor, in particular, the Constellation's drug, the CPI-0610, with ruxolitinib. So really kind of improving the proportion of patients having this dramatic response. We're also seeing some improvement in blood counts over time, suggesting that, yes, we are reducing inflammation and hitting that pathway with an on-target effect. So I think that's another exciting development. And additional drugs are being looked at. You mentioned LSD1 inhibitor. There's also a PI3 delta kinase inhibitor that's being developed in myelofibrosis, both as single agent and potentially in combination. So hitting this disease from a number of different pathways, I think, is certainly a key to moving forward.
As I tried to make sense of all of these evolving options, one, I'm very excited that there are so many. You know, having been involved in this field now for many years, you know, I remember well when we had basically no drugs for myelofibrosis, and the trials we did were largely from agents that were really developed for completely different reasons. You know, so there was really not a lot of rationale around it. You know, I view them in different groups. You know, so one, JAK inhibition is clearly beneficial, without question. Ruxolitinib has made a tremendous impact. Fedratinib is a wonderful drug and a strong option for individuals to consider, you know, today for people for second line. Momelotinib and pactinib, I think, both have important roles to play. And again, we might find that there's very specific niches for each of these. So I kind of view JAK inhibitors and kind of the non-JAK inhibitors. And although I think from a drug development standpoint, there has been the, okay, you're on a JAK inhibitor, then you fail JAK inhibition, then you go on to something else. You know, I think the reality of how we treat most malignancies is combination therapies. You know, so I think the real questions evolving will be combinations that, do they begin up front? You know, both CPI-0610 and navitoclax are looking at that combination kind of as upfront to impact. Or do we add these other drugs in addition? And do we add them, you know, in the near future? You know, you go on your JAK inhibitor, the best one for you. You're on it for 3 months. We assess for response. Maybe you're on it for 6 months. And then we add something else in. So what do you think, particularly as you think, as your panel convenes, you know, at some point in the future, and you try to weigh those pluses and minuses of combination upfront versus delayed addition of a second agent, what are some of the key data you will be looking for in the phase 3 studies to make that decision?
Oh, that is definitely a key issue right now. We have all these agents being developed in combination, so JAK inhibitor plus drug X, Y, or Z. And really, that's the big question in my mind. So if you have a patient who can go on a JAK inhibitor and have roughly, you know, 30 to 40% of the population have an excellent spleen response, good symptom response, why would you add in a second drug at the very beginning, you know, potentially increasing the toxicity of the combination versus, well, let's give it a couple of months and see if we need to push harder. So I think that's really the challenge, because sequencing will be the key. Is it better to do them both up front right from the beginning, or wait a little bit on a single agent before adding the second agent in? And so what I think, there's a couple of things from the big randomized phase 3 trials I'll be kind of watching closely. One, for certainly, is the toxicity. Is there going to be perceivable differences in toxicity between one agent and two agents? The second thing is overall survival, of course. But that might be difficult to show, as you mentioned. Survival is pretty good for these folks. It's not like we're treating, you know, an aggressive acute leukemia in folks who are advanced age, that's going to be kind of challenging in terms of their survival. And we're not going to have as many events to sort out overall survival. But the other thing I think too with the population of these patients is the survival is variable. It's not just the lengthened survival of folks with myelofibrosis, but the variability, ranging from some patients who are, even with the higher risk categories, survival can be quite variable from patient to patient. So I think it's also a breadth issue there, showing a survival advantage in a clinical trial. So things I would look more towards, stuff like progression-free survival or duration of benefit type analyses, where if you go on to a combination therapy and your response is the response is significantly longer than a single agent, I think that would be an advantage. Although then we're going to have to show that even at a later disease progression, adding a second, you know, a second agent wouldn't be beneficial. But I think those are things I would be looking at, is the direct comparison of toxicities between the two arms, as well as the durability of responses. I think those are going to be what we're going to need to help separate that out. Because I agree with you that survival is going to be pretty darn tough to show in some of these studies.
Agree. I think there's going to be much for us to try to decipher. One, I think that the combinations are clearly more active, but you're right, they may come both with significant increases in toxicity as well as expense, you know, and how does all of that factor in? You know, is it a broader response or a deeper response? You know, so for the individual that would have had a spleen and symptom response with single agent, is both agents, you know, necessary? I think a couple of things are going to evolve. One, I think we're going to learn more about, let's say, these endpoints that have up to this point been exploratory: variant allele frequency, fibrosis, survival timelines, other perhaps biomarkers, perhaps reversal of things like ASX01, you know, these sorts of things. Two, we're going to learn more about matching up therapies with individual patients based on their phenotype. You know, they have anemic, or do we add luspatercept, or do we consider momelotinib as their frontline JAK inhibitor? If they're myelodepleted, is pacvenib the anchor drug? As well as increasing information about the genetic signature and profile of these patients upfront. You know, we might find that there's a subset that, again, benefit from CPI-0610 as a combination upfront, or maybe they benefit from fedratinib as their frontline therapy, or maybe we add navitoclax upfront because of their status in terms of their apoptosis. So many exciting things coming. What I share with patients is that I'm very hopeful. I think that this evolution of new therapies is going to have increasingly significant impact on them. But I do think that how we manage these patients may become more complex as we expect more from our therapies and there's more nuance to adjustments. So final words, things you're most looking forward to learning about myelofibrosis in 2021?
I think the simple answer is all of it. I mean, it's exciting to be part of this community, be part of this field at such a time where, you know, the science is really kind of coming into the clinics. And we're starting to explore new therapies beyond JAK inhibitors. I mean, it's truly is amazing. So certainly seeing new agents that can extend survival, potentially reverse disease, adverse disease factors, and really just make patients' lives better. I'm excited to get on with and get these things to patients.
I would share that sentiment. And again, the sense of hope, as well as knowing that we're learning about the advances being made in parallel in myelodysplastic syndrome, in acute leukemia, you know, many of the drivers of disease evolution, similar aspects of the somatic mutations are really shared with these other diseases, even the issue of clonal hematopoiesis, aging, and how that acts as a forward pressure in terms of progressive disease. So much more to come, and look forward to future podcasts where my good friend Aaron and I can chat and speculate and be excited about the myelofibrosis pipeline. So deepest thanks. Final word, Aaron.
Oh, boy. You know, 2020, there was a lot of great science that came out. And I think looking forward to 2021, we will continue to capitalize on that and just looking forward to it.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Sierra Oncology. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives in cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.